some number, I don't know, 15, 20, 25, I'm not sure the number, but troublemaker schools around the country. These are one day kind of mini labor notes conferences by region, and we hold them in all over the country in different cities, and sometimes it's offered there. The books are good. The books help. And then the other thing that people can do is if you are, we pretty much always say, you just want to talk to someone, just get in touch with Labor Notes. Like someone's going to talk to you. We have a staff that is also spread out all over the country and have different beats. You know, so some work on Teamsters, some work on with educators, some work with healthcare. And anyway, we try and cover all the industries and all the unions. And then we have other people like me, just retired, you know, board members and others in our network. So you can call and say, can someone talk with me? If you are specifically interested, you're in an industry and you want to know, who are the other people? Are there other people in my industry that have started a caucus? How can I get in touch with them? We help people do that all the time. We serve as a platform for a lot of national networks. So, for example, as Jamie knows, there has been a platform through Labor Notes for postal workers of different unions. There is a platform, there's a national network for rail workers who are also in 5 or 6 different unions, and they've come together. Educators, higher education, healthcare, IATSE, there's a lot going on in the entertainment industry, and we can help you connect with other people. We also are in a kind of a long-term project to try and get a lot of information up and available to people about caucus. There is really no other source for it in the country, unfortunately. So we're working on that. And I can also mention that I'm just finishing up writing a book for Labor Notes about many of the things that we've talked about here. And it should be available hopefully by this winter. And, you know, there will be resources in there as well.
All right. Look forward to that book when it comes out. And then again, the website is labornotes.org. where folks can sign up for the newsletter, look at the events schedule. And that wraps it up for this session of Labor Notes, Labor Radio.
Thank you so much.
This session of Labor Radio on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, this Monday and every Monday at 6 p.m. We've been speaking with Ellen David Friedman. I'm Jamie Partridge with my co-host, Laura Wadlin. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
This is Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
Baby, you understand me now.
Hi, greetings and welcome to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli, and today we are honored to have with us Mr. Martin Lockett. How you doing, Martin?
Excellent. How you doing, Adam?
Hey, good, man. Thanks for being on. Let's get right to it. You have an amazing story, and tell us about yourself and how you got to where you're at today.
Absolutely. So I grew up right here in Northeast Portland in the 80s. And if anybody is familiar with what Portland was like back then, let me just say, is vastly different than it is today. So back then, just kind of set the scene, there was a lot of, there were gangs coming up from California, kind of fighting for, you know, territory, drug territory, stuff like that. Drive-by shootings were a regular thing. Street prostitution was rampant, you know, the crack epidemic, I mean, you name it, right? And so with all that going on though, so my parents, they really did everything they could to try to shield my twin brother and my two sisters and myself from all of that chaos. So they were really adamant about having us enrolled in like after school sports and Little League and Cub Scouts and Pop Warner football and just all this stuff, and just making sure they were really, really, you know, active in our lives. So that worked for until I got to high school, right? So when I got to high school, I was a terribly shy kid, and all that mattered, as many kids can attest, like you have to have a crew to hang out with, right? You can't be a loner. And so that kind of left me at the mercy of basically like anybody who would accept me. And so this led to me, I remember I was 14 when I had my first drink of alcohol. I was at a party and, you know, this guy hands my brother and me a couple beers. And I remember when I drank that alcohol, I remember like physiologically my chest heated up, and then like all my inhibitions started to come down. And it was a trip how I could finally now just kind of settle in, talk to people, mingle, talk to girls. And I was like, man, I am loving this, because it's like a miracle drug that allows me to kind of come out of this shy, timid shell and open up and just be loose. And like, this is the Martin that I want to be. And so for a couple years, that was kind of my relationship with alcohol, if you will. It was just kind of, you know, social lubricant. Now, I'll also say, Adam, around that time I started to drink alcohol, smoke cigarettes and stuff like that, my crew and I also started to kind of steal cars, go joyriding. So I got arrested a couple times when I was 15 and 16, got put on probation with the JDH. So that was kind of also my introduction to the criminal justice system as a youth. And so fast forward a couple years at 16, my drinking and my relationship with alcohol took a more sinister turn. So now I'm starting to drink more heavily, more frequently, because I'm really trying to self-medicate, because I have terrible self-esteem. I have a very low self-concept. I am struggling to accept who I am as a Black kid in America, and seeing everybody around me struggling, on crack, in poverty. And I'm thinking, well, what does that mean for my life? Like, I want to go to college. I want to work downtown. I want to wear a suit on Tuesdays. Like, but that's not in the cards for me, because like nobody around me is doing that. And so it sent me into this depression and just this low sense of self, because, you know, mental health and challenges wasn't something that was regularly talked about in my household. I was left to deal with these feelings and manage them. And really the only way that I know how, which is to drink a 40, right? To drink, you know, St. Ives, hard liquor, whatever I can get my hands on. And so I started to drink before I went to school. I drank during my lunch breaks, skipping school, you know, joyriding, drinking after school. Like, I was just living day to day to get through the day and numb my pain and just, you know, kind of check out from all of it. What that led to is me, obviously, you know, not graduating high school. That's not a surprise there. And then getting into more serious crime with my buddies. So right after high school, at the ages of 18 and 19, five of us were sent to prison with sentences that ranged from 5 to 31 years. And so I got sentenced to 5.5 years for my part in an armed robbery that I helped to conspire with my guys. I didn't physically go in and do the robbery, but I kind of drew out the floor plan. And so I was involved, obviously. So I go to prison at 19. My family is, you know, utterly disappointed, crushed, but my family is the most supportive family you're going to find. So they supported me through that. They encouraged me to get my GED, kind of get back to my spirituality. We grew up in a church and stuff like that. So I kind of, you know, I started getting back to that. And I got my GED, and then I went to the boot camp program that allowed me to get out early. So I did like 3.5 years when I was 22 years old. I got out, came back to Portland with my family. I immediately got a job at a warehouse in Southeast Portland. I am going to treatment groups twice a week because my parole required it. And then I enrolled in community college courses at PCC Cascade because I wanted to become a nurse. So I'm really starting to think about my life seriously, think about my future, set up some goals. I saved up $5,000 working at that warehouse job. And I bought my first car. You know, I got my license. I didn't have my license when I went in. So that was a priority for me when I got out. So I'm like putting these building blocks in place for my life. And I'm not drinking. I'm not hanging out with my guys. I'm kind of, you know, doing it straight and narrow. But what that led to when I was 22, 23, is that I felt like I was missing out. I felt like I'm young. I should be having fun. My guys are out in the clubs every weekend, meeting girls, you know, of course, drinking and smoking and doing all that stuff. To me, I'm like, they're having fun. And yeah, I'm doing okay things in life, but like, I'm not really having a lot of fun. And so I kind of convinced myself that it's okay if I can hang out with these guys, I can go to the clubs, I can do this, I can do that. I don't have to drink, right? I can just hang out. But, you know, I'm sure somebody has heard the phrase that, you know, if you hang out in the barbershop long enough, you will get a haircut. And so that's what happened. I got a haircut, numerous haircuts, if you will. And now I'm drinking. I'm drinking every day, drinking very heavily, even though still, you know, holding down my job. I'm still going to school twice a week. I'm still paying my bills. And so a lot of people would look at my life, and I think this further caused me to, you know, lean heavily into my addiction, is because there were so many things that was going right in my life that I could point to and say, well, my life, it's not really that bad that I'm drinking. Like, I'm not this, you know, guy underneath the bridge with a paper bag, right? Like, that's not me. So like that, like that's an alcoholic, right? I'm not really an alcoholic. That's how I justified it. And so I drank and drove every single day for 19 months leading into what would change the rest of my life and frankly, countless other people's lives. So on New Year's Eve of 2003, I've been drinking all day, partying all night, and I sped through a red light right here on MLK in Fremont in Northeast Portland. And I crashed into a car. I killed two people and severely disabled a third person in that crash. And I am hauled downtown on two counts of manslaughter in the first degree and then assault two for the guy who got injured. All three are measure 11 mandatory minimum person-to-person crimes. So I know that at 24 years of age, I'd only been out 2 years. I know I'm going back to prison for about 20 years. Like, I know that because I'm keen on the law. And so about 3 or 4 days later, I'm in my cell just minding my own business. And I noticed that someone had slid the Oregonian underneath my door, and I was perplexed. I didn't know why they were giving me a newspaper. I didn't ask anybody to see a paper. So I pick it up. I start to thumb through this paper, and I see my picture on the front page of the Metro section. And as I'm reading each paragraph, like, the lives of my victims started to unfold. At that point, they were just, I don't say it flippantly, they weren't, you know, they were people, but I only knew their names, right? I had no idea who they were, what their lives were like. So I'm reading about these people's lives, and I'm finding out that, number one, they were in long-term recovery at the time of the crash. One has 16 years clean, one has 17 years clean. They were heavily involved in the recovery community here in Portland. They would watch women's children so ladies could attend AA and NA meetings. They were volunteers with Volunteers of America, with Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Like, they were all about the recovery scene. And in fact, the night that this happened, they were actually coming home after celebrating at a clean and sober New Year's Eve party at the convention center when they were struck and killed by a drunk driver. And the columnist, he had talked about he called it a palpable irony that these people who had devoted their lives to help other people get clean and sober would have their lives taken by a drunk driver. And then it got to the end of the article, and this phrase that he ended that article with changed my life forevermore. It further compels me to do this work that I'm doing today, which I'll talk about in a minute. What he said was, he said, perhaps the person they will have ended up helping the most is the man who's charged with killing them. And like, it was such a heavy, profound statement. In that moment, I could not fully appreciate what he had said because I'm still thinking about my life. I'm 24. I'm going to prison for the next 20 years. Like, I don't know how this situation is, you know, possibly going to help me because it's over for me. Like, my life is done. And so, but it was also a phrase that I knew I couldn't ignore. And so I kind of got back to my spirituality. I started to meditate on that phrase. I would hear it numerous times played in my head. I would pray about it, asking for revelation into that statement. And then it finally came to me that the only way this utter tragedy will not be in vain is if I carry on these people's legacies. And if I literally make it my life's purpose and mission to carry that torch in honor of the work that they were doing. And so I made the commitment in the cell that day, right? I had no idea how that was going to manifest over the next however many years I was going to be in prison, because at that point I hadn't been sentenced yet. I knew I was going to be there for a while, but I didn't know what this mission would look like, but I just knew I was committed. So a few months later, I take a plea bargain for 17 and a half years, day for day. That's 210 months. I knew I wasn't going to earn a single day off for good behavior, for going to school, for any of that. And so that was my fate. So then I get to state prison a couple months later. And I figure if I'm going to like really set out into this mission of helping other people get clean and sober, and the most effective way to do that was to become a drug and alcohol counselor. All I had was a GED at the time, so I knew I needed more education, obviously. And so I got involved as a tutor in the GED program. I figure if I'm in the educational setting, maybe that'll get me on this path. So I do that. And then I found out that I could take one community college course per term at the prison for like $25 a class. They had a scholarship program set up that allowed us to do that. So I did that for a little while, a couple years maybe. And then I tragically, unexpectedly, we lost our father. But in that happening, we were able to get his life insurance policies and his pension and stuff like that. So I took a chunk of that money and I invested it into my education. So now I'm taking classes, correspondence classes from Louisiana State University and Indiana University and other colleges. So I parlayed all of that over the next few years into a bachelor's in sociology from Colorado State University, Pueblo. And then 3 years later, 2016, I got a master's in psychology from California Coastal University. Then I enrolled into a substance abuse treatment program within the prison, where it was 5 days a week. I did it for 7 months, and I really learned like the difference between sobriety and recovery. And I'm getting more knowledge about, you know, treatment language and stuff like that. And so I paired that with my formal education, and then now I'm starting to mentor guys. So I graduated that program, and now I'm working as kind of an intern in the program, working with guys one-on-one, leading the group, doing assessments, doing orientations, doing all the clinical stuff so that I can get the clinical hours needed to become a substance abuse counselor in Oregon, which I got in 2019. Again, I'm still in prison at this time. And then I start to tell my story at DUI victim impact panels within the prison setting. They would bring in a volunteer from the outside who had lost a loved one to a DUI driver, or they had been hit by a DUI driver, and maybe they had like a traumatic brain injury or lost a limb or something like that. And these people would come in and tell their story. And then one of us on the inside who was in there for the same crime would tell our story, obviously, you know, being fully, you know, accountable and remorseful and all of that. So it was a very, very healing environment. You know, it was really kind of like you hear about the restorative justice model. It really was that. And so that really confirmed to me that when I got out of prison a couple years later, I knew I wanted to continue with that work. So now I've been out 3 years. I just got off parole about 3 weeks ago. And in this 3-year time span, I have traveled the country telling my story at DUI victim impact panels, alcohol highway safety classes, traffic safety classes, high schools, colleges, conferences, in a bunch of different spaces. And so that's what I've done in my private life, in my kind of 9-to-5 work, if you will. When I got out in June of 2021, I started working as a call counselor at Lines for Life. Our main office is in Southwest Portland, is where our call center is. We employ about, I think about 280 people across the country in about 35 states. We do suicide prevention. We do substance abuse prevention, as well as just general kind of mental health awareness. So I'm the director of cultural engagement. I've been doing that for the last 9 months. I got promoted from a call counselor to doing that. And what that work looks like is I run a small team. We are in spaces of color here in the Portland metro area, and we do workshops around mental health and suicide prevention. We do mental health first aid trainings in barbershops and hair salons and churches, because we know that for a lot of Black folks in particular, we know that they're comfortable with talking to their you know, pastor or barber or hairstylist about, you know, what's going on and how they're feeling. So we figure if these community leaders and pillars are already, you know, listening to, you know, some heavy stuff, we want to make sure that they're equipped with the proper skills to be able to, like, effectively listen to these things, and then how to appropriately respond, right? What you should say, what you shouldn't say, how to connect people to local resources if they need further help and things like that. So that's been a really effective program of ours. You know, we also have recently gotten into the prison system to also do mental health first aid trainings with the adults in custody so that they can be aware of their own mental health and coping skills. And then it also enables them to be able to help folks around them who might be struggling. So in a nutshell, that's what we do as an organization, as my small department. That is generally my story.
Martin, can you talk more about the connections with drug and alcohol abuse and suicide? And again, you mentioned how it disproportionately affects Black and brown folks historically and contemporarily.
Well, yeah. So we know that the vast majority of folks who die by suicide, I want to say it's upwards of 90%, are usually under the influence of a substance. And that substance is usually alcohol, because alcohol is a disinhibitor. You start to drink, and you will start to do things, say things that you normally wouldn't do, right? Because it literally lowers those inhibitions. So it gives people, for lack of a better word, the courage to follow through with on a suicide attempt that they otherwise would not have because of fears and things like that that are normally there to protect us. And so that is something we focus on heavily when we're doing our trainings. We talk about the things that, you know, firearm, that being, you know, something that puts folks at a higher risk if they have access to a firearm and they feel hopeless. And then there's substances that they have access to. That's kind of the daily trio, if you will. And so strong correlation between substance use and suicide for folks who are struggling with mental health issues as it is. We know disproportionately, you know, just over the last several years since the pandemic, we've seen numbers within the Black community go up pretty substantially around the rates of suicide, but in particular with Black youth. And what they've done is they've actually, so it's gotten to a crisis point where the Congressional Black Caucus in D.C. a few years back actually, you know, took it to the floor for a vote and lobbied for monies to be put into researching why Black kids are killing themselves at an all-time high rate. And so far, what they found is that typically for white kids who die by suicide, there's usually, you know, underlying mental illness such as, you know, depression or bipolar and things like that. Whereas with Black kids, it is largely around systemic racism and trauma. So the fact that they're turning on the TV nowadays and social media being everywhere, and they're seeing kids who are their age and looks like them being, you know, killed by police and things like that at an alarming rate, then that conveys something to them that, well, my life really doesn't matter a whole lot, right? You know, being exposed to racism, overt racism, covert racism, microaggressions, that is traumatizing, right? And people think that, you know, you have to physically, personally experience, go through something to experience trauma. But no, there's vicarious trauma, right? I can observe somebody being traumatized and brutalized, and that will have a traumatizing effect on me, right? That takes a toll on my psyche, especially when I identify with the person who is experiencing the trauma. The data is, you know, revealing these facts. That's why we deliver culturally responsive trainings when we do these trainings in the Black community and talking about how suicide and ideation and mental health overall is affecting Black and brown communities.
Can you talk more about how people can access those services? And I know you mentioned the hotline. So if you want to keep repeating the number, make sure people are getting that so they can, you know, either memorize it, write it down or whatnot, you know, and share that with other people, too, who they think might need it.
Absolutely. So it used to be this long 1-800 number. I mean, I know it by heart, but it doesn't really matter. But the suicide crisis line was this long 800 number. And so what they said was, a couple of years back in July of 2022, nationally, they said, we want to make the suicide crisis line accessible and easy for people to remember. In the same way we know if we're in an emergency, we dial 911. So now if you are in a behavioral crisis, you dial 988. So that is the national, no matter where you are, In the United States of America, if you dial 988, you will be connected to a trained, you know, social worker, clinician who can assist you with that and help you with that and de-escalate and get you to a safe place and then further, you know, connect you with resources in your local area. So 988, I would highly, highly encourage that for anybody. And here's the thing. You don't have to be experiencing suicidal ideation. If you're just having a bad day, if you're going through relationship issues, or you know, your kids are stressing you out, or you are a kid, and your parents are stressing you out, job is hard, your boss is getting on your nerve, whatever the case, you can call 988 and get support. And then if you want further support in your community, then they can, you know, they're all experts at finding the resources in your locale and texting those over to you, or emailing those over to you, or giving them to you right there over the phone, so that you can get continued care.
It's interesting you mentioned, you know, if your boss is giving you a hard time, and you've also informed me before about kind of the differences of the experiences people have at different occupations, and how some occupations even have a higher propensity for drug and or alcohol usage and or suicide rates. Can you also connect that to people inside? Because so many people inside are working or workers too, and outside as well.
Yeah, so we know that most folks who, the majority rather, of folks who die by suicide in institutional settings, they do so when they are in segregation, right? So again, it just speaks to the fact that humans are meant to be in connection with other human beings. We do not do well in isolation. So when you isolate a human being for weeks and months at a time, there are many innumerable psychological effects, and suicide is a result, sadly, for a lot of folks inside. So I know there's been strong advocacy around totally abolishing segregation units, or at least severely limiting the amount of time you can keep somebody in segregation, aka the hole. So you know, that's one of the fronts that people were fighting that fight on. As far as occupations, so we know that the construction industry, which is predominantly male oriented, they've experienced a lot higher rate of suicide today than in years past. So we have an initiative strictly for the construction industry. We have folks show up on construction sites to deliver this very specific suicide prevention training. It's just been growing and growing over the last couple of years. So we're really, really excited to see that flourish. You know, you think about guys who are away from their families for, you know, weeks at a time, maybe months on these construction sites. Guys are less apt to kind of, you know, talk about their feelings in general because of the stigma. And so guys will self-medicate with alcohol generally. And again, we just talked about earlier the correlation between substance use and suicide and suicide attempts when there's obviously a mental health crisis going on. And so so that's one of the industries we've seen the rates of suicide be higher. There's also within the police force, more cops die by suicide than they do in the line of duty, you know, by an active shooter. And so that is also something that's, you know, that's being addressed. The farmers, the suicide prevention training that we do, they have adapted versions for culturally diverse populations, for farmers in rural areas, for law enforcement, first responders, so, and construction folks. So these different areas, occupations and otherwise that are disproportionately impacted by suicide, they really try to adapt the curriculum to meet those needs and to help mitigate it. So that's some of the work that we do as an organization.
Yeah, speaking of work, whether it's paid, unpaid volunteer work or whatnot, there's a lot of different ways people can plug in to support the work that you do and support the organization, Lions for Life. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so we have a robust volunteer program, both with adults and youth. And so we have adults who come in. In fact, a lot of our longtime employees who have been there, you know, 10, 15 years, a lot of them started off as volunteers, actually, as part-time volunteers, and then moved into a paid role. But they go through the same training as folks who are getting paid. You go through 6 weeks of intensive training, you know, about how to take the calls and how to access your support chat when you need to, and just, you know, everything you need to know to be successful. And then with our youth, we actually have young folks, youth who come down to the office to volunteer between 4 o'clock and 10 o'clock p.m. every day, 7 days a week. And they are taking calls on our youth line where their peers are calling in and they're taking the call. And these are young people who have gone through their own, you know, struggles around mental illness and, you know, suicide attempts and things like that. And obviously they've gotten treatment and they're much better today. And then they go through extensive training and then they now support their peers who are calling into the line to get help. Because we know that a lot of kids, you know, would typically rather talk to somebody around their age as opposed to an adult. And so we want to make sure that they have access to that. And if they don't want to call in, they can text as well. So I wish I had the number handy. It's if you just Google Oregon Youth Line, it will be the first, will be the only ones that pop up, obviously. And then you can, our number will be right there and the text information will be right there as well.
And the website for the organization is linesforlife.org. That's linesforlife.org. Martin, before we kind of close up, for those folks who are inside who are listening, those folks who are outside listening and having all those kind of different struggles, being locked up and or dealing with addiction and or, you know, alcohol abuse, any wishful words? Of course, there's no simple solution to this. And, you know, part of it is people need to ask for help. And then there's these resources that are there to do that. So
absolutely. Yeah, I would just let folks know that, you know, as human beings, no matter what race, color, creed, whatever the case, you know, we're all human at the end of the day and we struggle because we're human beings. Nobody gets through life, you know, without any challenges. These challenges take a mental toll. And the worst thing we can do when we are struggling is to isolate. We're not built that way. We do better in connection. We do better in community. So I would encourage you to reach out either through my organization at 988 or a friend or a trusted family member just to have some real honest conversation, you know, because we need that support. We all need that support. And obviously, if you want more formal kind of therapy or whatever, we can definitely get you connected in that way as well. But that would be my thing, is just, you know, understand that we all go through stuff. Doesn't make you weak to reach.